Security was still at his post, but expected to be called back to Langley soon. The new president was settling in, things were chaotic and so on, according to Priddy, who seemed slightly irritated by the call. He and Kritz had never been close, and Priddy knew immediately that the guy was fishing. Kritz eventually said he was trying to find an old pal, a senior CIA analyst he had once played a lot of golf with. Name was Daly, Addison Daly, and he'd left Washington for a stint in Asia. Did Priddy perhaps know where he was now? Addison Daly was tucked away at Langley, and Priddy knew him well. I know the name, Priddy said. Maybe I can find him. Where can I reach you? Kritz gave him the number at the flat. Priddy called Addison Daly and passed along his suspicions. Daly turned on his recorder and called London on a secure line. Kritz answered the phone and went overboard with his delight at hearing from an old friend. He rambled on about how wonderful life was after the White House, after all those years playing the political game, how nice it was being a private citizen. He was anxious to renew old friendships and get serious about his golf game. Daly played along well. He offered that he too was contemplating retirement, almost 30 years in the service, and that he caught himself looking forward to an easier life. How's Teddy these days, Kritz wanted to know, and how's the new president? What's the mood in Washington with the new administration? Nothing changes much, Daly mused, just another bunch of fools. By the way, how's former President Morgan? Kritz didn't know, hadn't talked to him, in fact, might not talk to him for many weeks. As the conversation was winding down, Kritz said with a clumsy laugh, Don't guess anyone's seen Joel Backman. Daly managed to laugh, too. It was all a big joke. No, he said, I think the boy's well hidden. He should be. Kritz promised to call as soon as he returned to D.C. They'd play 18 holes at one of the good clubs, then have a drink, just like in the old days. What old days? Daly asked himself after he hung up. An hour later, the phone conversation was played for Teddy Maynard. Since the first two calls had been somewhat encouraging, Kritz pressed on. He'd always been one to work the phones like a maniac. He subscribed to the shotgun theory, fill the air with calls and something will happen. A rough plan was coming together. Another old pal had once been a senior staffer to the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and though he was now a well-connected lobbyist, he had allegedly maintained close ties to the CIA. They talked politics and golf, and eventually, much to Kritz's delight, the pal asked what exactly was President Morgan thinking when he pardoned Duke Mongo, the biggest tax evader in the history of America. Kritz claimed to have been opposed to the pardon, but managed to steer the conversation along to the other controversial reprieve. What's the gossip on Backman? He asked.
You were there, answered his pal.
Yes, but where did Maynard stash him? That's the big question.
So it was a CIA job? His friend asked.
Of course, Kritz said with a voice of authority. Who else could sneak him out of the country in the middle of the night?
That's interesting, said his pal,
who then became very quiet. Kritz insisted on a lunch the following week, and that's where they left the conversation. As Kritz feverishly worked the phone, he marveled once again at his endless list of contacts. Power did have its rewards. Joel or Marco said goodbye to Hermano at 5:30 in the afternoon, completing a three-hour session that had gone virtually non-stop. Both were exhausted. The chilly air helped clear his head as he walked the narrow streets of Treviso. For the second day, he dropped by a small corner bar and ordered a beer. He sat in the window and watched the locals hurry about, some rushing home from work, others shopping quickly for dinner. The bar was warm and smoky, and Marco once again drifted back to prison. He couldn't help himself. The change had been too drastic, the freedom too sudden. There was still the lingering fear that he would wake up and find himself locked in the cell with some unseen prankster laughing hysterically in the distance. After the beer, he had an espresso, and after that he stepped into the darkness and shoved both hands deep into his pockets. When he turned the corner and saw his hotel, he also saw Luigi pacing nervously along the sidewalk smoking a cigarette.
As Marco crossed the street, Luigi came after him. "We are leaving immediately," he said. "Why?" Marco asked, glancing around, looking for bad guys. "I'll explain later. There's a travel bag on your bed. Pack your things as quickly as possible. I'll wait here." "What if I don't want to leave?" Marco asked. Luigi clutched his left wrist, thought for a quick second, then gave a very tight smile. "Then you might not last 24 hours, he said as ominously as possible. "Please, trust me." Marco raced up the stairs and down the hall, and was almost to his room before he realized that the sharp pain in his stomach was not from heavy breathing, but from fear. What had happened? What had Luigi seen or heard or been told? Who exactly was Luigi in the first place, and who was he taking orders from? As Marco yanked his clothes out of the tiny closet and flung them toward the bed, he asked all these questions and many more. When everything was packed, he sat for a moment and tried to collect his thoughts. He took deep breaths, exhaled slowly, told himself that whatever was happening was just part of the game. Would he be running forever? Always packing in a hurry, fleeing one room in search of another? It still beat the hell out of prison, but it would take its toll. And how could anyone possibly have found him this soon? He had been in Treviso only 4 days. When his composure was somewhat restored, he walked slowly down the hall, down the stairs, through the lobby where he nodded at the gawking clerk but said nothing, and out the front door. Luigi snatched his bag and tossed it into the trunk of a compact Fiat. They were on the outskirts of Treviso before a word was spoken. "Okay, Luigi, what's up?" Marco asked. "A change of scenery." "Got that. Why?" "Some very good reasons." "Oh, well, that explains everything." Luigi drove with his left hand, shifted gears frantically with his right, and kept the accelerator as close to the floor as possible while ignoring the brakes. Marco was already perplexed as to how a race of people could spend 2.5 leisurely hours over lunch, then hop in a car for a 10-minute drive across town at breakneck speed. They drove an hour, generally in a southward direction, avoiding the highways by clinging to the back roads. "Is someone behind us?" Marco asked more than once as they sped around tight curves on 2 wheels. Luigi just shook his head. His eyes were narrow, his eyebrows pinched together, his jaw clenched tightly when the cigarette wasn't near. He somehow managed to drive like a maniac while smoking calmly and never glancing behind them. He was determined not to speak, and that reinforced Marco's determination to have a conversation. "You're just trying to scare me, aren't you, Luigi? We're playing the spy game. You're the master. I'm the poor schmuck with the secrets. Scare the hell out of me and keep me dependent and loyal. I know what you're doing." "Who killed J.C. Hubbard?" Luigi asked, barely moving his lips. Backman suddenly wanted to go quiet. The mere mention of Hubbard made him freeze for a second. The name always brought the same flashback. A police photo of J.C. slumped against his brother's grave, the left side of his head blown away, blood everywhere, on the tombstone, on his white shirt, everywhere. "You have the file," Backman said. "It was a suicide." "Oh, yes. And if you believe that, then why did you decide to plead guilty and beg for protective custody in prison?" "I was scared. Suicides can be contagious." "Very true." "So you're saying that the boys who did the Hubbard suicide are after me?" Luigi confirmed it with a shrug. "And somehow they found out I was hiding in Treviso. It's best not to take chances." He would not get the details, if in fact there were any. He tried not to, but he instinctively glanced over his shoulder and saw the dark road behind them. Luigi looked in his rearview mirror and managed a satisfactory smile, as if to say, "They're back there, somewhere." Joel sank a few inches in his seat and closed his eyes. 2 of his clients had died first. Safi Mirza had been knifed outside a Georgetown nightclub 3 months after he hired Backman and handed over the only copy of Jam. The knife wounds were severe enough, but a poison had been injected, probably with the thrust of the blade. No witnesses.